Today we're going to look at Daniel chapter 7. It begins the second half of the book. It's a complex chapter with a lot of symbolism in it. If you haven't been here for the last few weeks as we look through Daniel and you may think, what on earth is this about? So we're going to look today at the first 8 verses. Hopefully I can finish the chapter next week, but I think we need to do this today. And for an opening scripture reading, I'm going to read some verses from Revelation chapter 13, and I'm pretty sure I've read these verses in here as an opening scripture reading before, but I concluded that it never hurts to hear the scripture read twice, and it does apply certainly to what we're going to be talking about today. This is going to have some odd language in it, and if it sounds strange to you, hopefully by the end of the day we will have clarified what some of this symbolism means. Revelation 13:1. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, 10 crowns, and on his head were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him?" There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And it was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overthrow them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. And if anyone has an ear, let him pay attention. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he will go. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. I've mentioned, I think 2 weeks ago, that Daniel chapters 5 and 6, which are the last two chapters that we studied, come chronologically after chapters 7 and 8. You remember hearing that? I think I said that. So if you wanted to read Daniel with all of the events in the book in sequential order, you would read chapters 1 through 4, then 7 and 8, then 5 and 6, and then 9 through 12. That would outline the book in chronological order. My choice, I could have done that, but I've chosen to stick with the ordering that we have in our Bibles, even though it's going to cause us to jump around a little bit on the timeline. Why these chapters are arranged as they are in non-chronological order, I think, is a fair question, and I've thought about it quite a lot. And I've come up with some reasons that I think the Bible, that Daniel assembled these chapters as he did. We should not overlook the fact that chapter 7 ends the Aramaic portion of Daniel that began in chapter 2, verse 4. You may remember, this is a book in the original languages that's written in two different languages. Parts of it are written in Hebrew and parts of it are written in Aramaic. The Aramaic portion begins in the middle of the fourth verse of the second chapter and go through the end of the 28th verse, which is the end of chapter 7. We need to keep this in mind, that there are two different languages used in this book, and there may have been a penchant for keeping the Aramaic section together as a unit. Had they put the text together in chronological order, you would have had Hebrew portion, an Aramaic portion, another Hebrew portion, and then another Aramaic section. So I think there's some value in keeping the Aramaic section together as a unit. The two chapters that follow chapter 4 chronologically, as I said, are chapters 7 and 8. Chapter 7 is written in Aramaic, while chapter 8 is written in Hebrew. By assembling the chapters the way he did, Daniel has retained the continuity of both sections, with chapter 7 serving more or less as a bridge between section 1, which is chapters 1 through 6, and the second section of the book, which is chapters 7 through 12. Daniel can be divided right down the middle, six chapters, six chapters. So chapter 7 then becomes a point of transition in the book of Daniel. Think about this. Chapters 1 through 6, though they have contained some prophetic material, trend toward an account of the historical events that occurred during the life of Daniel. For example, if you look back at those chapters, you'll see such things as the record of the capture and exile of Daniel and his friends by Nebuchadnezzar. You'll find the story about the challenges surrounding dietary laws and his education in Babylon. That section contains Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. It contains the account of the fiery furnace and the faithfulness of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It includes Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's second dream and his bout with insanity and then his ultimate restoration. And of course, the last couple of weeks, we've looked at Belshazzar's feast and the handwriting on the wall and the story of Daniel and the lion's den. All these are events that took place in the life of Daniel. When we come to chapter 7 and look forward through chapter 12, we're going to be focusing on four apocalyptic visions that Daniel has, all of which point forward to future events. So, in a sense, if we think about the subject matter of chapter 7, it shifts from the past, section 1, to the future, section 2. But the fact that it's written in Aramaic still links it back and ties it back to the first part or the first section of the book. Also, chapter 7 is foundational to the understanding of chapters 8 through 12. In chapters 2 through 6, but the first section of the book, we've learned a lot about the Gentile empires that will precede the establishment of God's kingdom on the earth. That knowledge is critical to the understanding of the visions and prophecies that we'll find in the remaining chapters of the book. But chapter 7 also contributes to our understanding of those future events that we're going to see as we go through the rest of the book of Daniel. In a sense, chapter 7 is an account of a vision, and it's a big overview. And then chapter 8, chapter 9, and then chapters 10 through 12, each of those three sections pick up a portion of the vision that Daniel had in chapter 7 and expand on it. So we need to understand the history that we've learned, but we also need to understand this chapter that we're going to tackle today. So I think another reason that Daniel may have ordered the chapters this way is that the Hebrew sections of the book tend to look at events from a Jewish perspective, while the Aramaic section of the book seems to look at events from the perspective of Gentiles, and thus a Gentile language was used to record those events. The content of the sections has some overlap, there are similarities, and yet the way the material is treated differently in the first section and the second section, primarily looking at a Gentile point of view versus a Jewish point of view. In chapter 2, for example, we learned about four great Gentile empires, and this information was given to Nebuchadnezzar for a very specific reason. God was teaching this Gentile king that it is the God of Israel who's sovereign, who sets up kings and kingdoms, even Gentile kings and kingdoms and empires. Then when we move on to the second section, in the Jewish perspective, the purpose of that section is really more to encourage the Jewish exiles that God has not abandoned them and forsaken the covenants. So here we have this body of people who are in exile in Babylon who could very easily think that God has rejected his covenants, that he has turned his back on his people. What we're looking at then in this last section of the book are words from God that are designed to encourage the Jews in exile that he has not forsaken them. So though they're living in Babylon now, these Jews can look forward to a time when God will bring them back and restore them to the promised land. God has not forsaken his people. That's a central message of these next chapters. This is vital to the faith of the Jews to understand this, and they're living under divine discipline in a foreign land. And this is an important message to them. God has not forsaken you. So chapter 7 becomes a transition chapter. It links these two halves of the book together. It moves us more into the latter days, to the end of this age, so it's very forward-looking from this point on. And it shifts our thinking from a Gentile perspective to looking at these events from the perspective of the Jewish exiles. Now, it's an important chapter. In fact, Daniel's vision set the stage for the subsequent apocalyptic literature that we see both in the Old and New Testaments. If you want to know where the foundation stone for the book of Revelation is, it's in Daniel. Daniel is really the key to understanding prophetic literature and apocalyptic literature throughout both Testaments. John Walvoord made an interesting comment about this in his commentary on Daniel. Walvoord wrote, in case you don't know who he is, when I was at DTS, he was the president of the seminary, and his area of expertise is prophecy. Here's what he says. He says, as interpreted by conservative expositors, the vision of Daniel provides the most comprehensive and detailed prophecy of future events to be found any place, anywhere in the Old Testament. He goes on to affirm that Daniel indeed is divided logically into these two sections that we've discussed, with six chapters in each section. And then he makes a specific comment about chapter 7. He says, from the standpoint of world history, Daniel's vision in chapter 7 is both a summary of what's been revealed before, especially in the vision of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. That's the story of the statue. And the outline of world history with which the last half of Daniel is primarily concerned. And I would add to this observation that certainly the vision of the Son of Man in verses 13 and 14 of this chapter spotlights the Old Testament revelation of Messiah. We're not going to get to those verses today, but we will next week. So let's turn to Daniel chapter 7. And let me read for you the first three verses, and then I'll make a few comments. And some of my comments today, I'm going to be stopping in the middle of this vision, so there's not going to be a lot of summarization at the end. I'm just trying to get through the imagery that's here today, and so I'm going to be making some specific comments about what some of these things mean, at least as I understand them. Chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related a summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking, and in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and the four great beasts were coming up from the sea, and they were different from one another. Notice that the date of Daniel's first vision is the first year of Belshazzar. Nabonidus, as you remember from our previous lessons, made Belshazzar co-regent in his third year. So this vision of chapter 7 occurred in 553 BC. At this point in time, Daniel is approximately 68 years old. We don't know exactly. So you can see as we begin chapter 7, we've jumped back in time 14 years before the handwriting on the wall incident of the previous chapters. So we've moved back in time for 14 years. This is the first year of King Belshazzar. In fact, let me lay out for you the timeline that we have here with respect to these four visions, and that's where I hope this chart will fit in. Down in, I believe it's the lower right-hand corner, I've tried to point out when the visions occurred on the timeline. In the most general sense, the first two visions that Daniel has, which is chapters 7 and 8, occurred during the Babylonian period. The second two, which is chapter 9 and then 10 through 12, occur during the Persian period. Daniel gives a date for each one of these visions because he wants to ground what he's saying in the prophecies in the timeline of the 6th century BC, not the 2nd century BC, as some people have claimed. With regard to the two visions during the Babylonian period, the first one is in chapter 7. It takes place during the first year of Belshazzar, which is 553 BC. And the second vision, chapter 8, takes place in the third year of Belshazzar, which is somewhere between 551 and 550 BC. Then we had the last two visions occur during the Persian period. Daniel's third vision is chapter 9. It occurs in the first year of Darius the Mede, which would put him at 539 BC for the third vision. And then the fourth vision, which is in chapters 10 through 12, occurred during the third year of Cyrus, which would be 536 to 535 BC. So these visions occur during the historical periods that we've already covered. According to verse 1, Daniel had a vision and he wrote down the details of that vision. I suspect he wrote them down in specific details because he wanted to contemplate what he had seen over time. He wanted to be able to recall everything. And then we're told that he included a summary of those facts, those details, in this book. So it looks to me like what we have in the book of Daniel is not an explicit statement of every absolute detail that he saw. He saw information we don't have. What we have in the book of Daniel is this summary that he wrote. The Aramaic term that he uses for summary is the word for head. It's also the word for chief. So what this means is that he wrote down the most important points, the chief points, the things that were the big bullet points, if you will, of what he saw. But Daniel saw more than we have record of in his book. So there's definitely information that he received that we do not have in the book of Daniel. It seems that he was asleep when these visions took place. If we were to look ahead to chapter 9, we would find that the vision in chapter 9 occurred when he was awake. But here he's asleep. There are two words that are used in parallel with one another, dream and vision. And when these two words occur together like this, what we're talking about is what I would call a revelatory dream. It's a dream that is a dream, and yet it's more than that. It is a dream that is designed to produce an understanding of information that God wants to reveal to Daniel. Revelatory dreams differ, but this particular experience, I think we would agree, would be unintelligible to Daniel had God not provided an interpretation of these symbolic things through an intermediary. And we'll find out next week in verse 16 that this intermediary that explained the details to Daniel, that helped him understand what these things mean, was an angel. Verse 2. Daniel's account of the dream doesn't begin in verse 1. It begins with the phrase, "I was looking," in verse 2. You may notice he refers to himself in the third person in verse 1. He says, "Then he wrote," referring to himself in the third person. But once we move to the next verse, verse 2, he says, "I was looking." So what we have here is Daniel's own firsthand account of this vision. Now this phrase, "I was looking," may look innocuous when we first see it, but it's an important phrase. It's actually a participle. Why would I mention that to you? Because a participle tends to indicate continuous action, that this is something that went on over time. And it's written in that intensive stem that we've talked about before. In Aramaic, there's a way of intensifying the meaning of verbs by writing them in a certain way. So this is a participle indicating continuous action, and it's written in the intensive stem to indicate that this is something that happened over time, and it was something that Daniel considered extremely important. He was observing what he saw in this dream, in this vision, very intently. It was very important to him. So we're going to see this phrase occur 10 times in the 7th chapter. Whenever a phrase occurs 10 times in a chapter, you have to conclude that it's important. That's why I'm mentioning this, not just to talk about a point of grammar. So he says here, "I was looking." In the other 9 occurrences, it will be appropriate to translate that "I continued looking," because he is continuing to be intently involved in observing what God is giving him in this dream. It places Daniel squarely in the act of viewing a scene, if you will, that's being played out before him. There's a lot of symbolism in this chapter, and it begins when we read, "Daniel sees the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea." The four winds of heaven simply refers to a great turbulence in the atmosphere that represents forces that seek to wreak havoc on the nations. These winds seem to originate contrary to nature. Normally, You'll have a west wind or a south wind or a north wind or an east wind. You don't normally have winds blowing from all directions at the same time. This is expressed this way so that we understand that this is not something that happens every day. This is a time of extreme turbulence and extreme chaos and confusion in the time of the Gentiles. He refers to the Great Sea. He doesn't name this sea because it's intended to represent something other than the sea. And actually, there's an interesting verse in the 60th chapter of Isaiah. It's actually verse 5. Let me read it to you. It says, "Your heart will thrill and rejoice because of the abundance of the sea." And now listen to what that phrase is in parallel to. "Because of the abundance of the sea will be turned to you, the wealth of the nations will come to you." So abundance and wealth are parallel. Sea and nations are parallel. Often in Scripture, the sea is symbolic of the Gentile nations. You can reference also Isaiah 27:1 and Isaiah 57:20, but I think in this Isaiah 60 verse 5 is a good one because we see sea and nation in parallel to one another. So when he says he sees this chaos and this turbulence and it's stirring up the great sea, what he is talking about here is chaos and havoc with respect to the Gentile nations. So in the context of turbulent winds, this describes the turmoil that will prevail during the times of the Gentiles, and it will be a turmoil that will increase as we move toward the end of the age. It'll reach its maximum intensity in the final form of the Fourth Empire during the tribulation period. Verse 3. "The vision continues until four beasts rise out of the sea." It should not be a surprise to you that these beasts arise out of the sea, because keep in mind what we're talking about are the nations. That they arise out of the sea successively instead of simultaneously indicates that these are empires that are successive in nature, one arising after the other out of this mass of humanity called the Gentile nations. He uses the term great to indicate the size of the beast. This is designed to imply that it's a powerful beast. And he mentions that each of the four beasts is different from one another. This doesn't mean that they are absolutely qualitatively different in every respect, but they're different in one way or another. These successive Gentile empires, we already know what they are. We learned about them in chapter 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's first dream of the statue. They are the Chaldean Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire under Alexander, and the Roman Empire. And each of these empires was similar in some ways, but they were also diverse in character. For example, they differed in how governmental authority was organized. The strong monarchy of the Neo-Babylonian Empire differed greatly from the Republic of Rome. This is an area where they are quite different. They also differed in size, they differed in power, they differed in the geography that each controlled. And I think this is what Daniel's referring to when he says that these beasts were different one from another. Now, the vision itself is described in verses 4 through 14. The interpretation is given in verses 15 through 28. But since we're not going to get through all of those verses, I'm going to move now to verse 4 and only read through verse 8. Here he describes the four beasts. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, "Arise, devour much meat." After I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, and extremely strong, and it had iron teeth that were large. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it. That is, the previous three, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and it had a mouth that was uttering boasts. So these are the four beasts that he sees coming out of the sea or out of the Gentile nations. The first beast is described in verse 4, and it's said to be like a lion. It's like a lion, but it also has wings like an eagle, so it's like an eagle. Its wings were plucked out, which I think simply means they were rendered inoperative, and a human mind was given to it. This first beast, this beast that's similar to a lion, parallels the head of gold in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. So we have to look at chapter 7 in parallel with chapter 2. The first beast parallels the head of gold in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. And since the head of gold represents Nebuchadnezzar, we know this from chapter 2, verses 32 and 38. This lion beast that Daniel saw must represent Nebuchadnezzar and certainly the empire which he ruled, which was the Chaldean Empire. It's not a difficult identification. The prophet Jeremiah, who was contemporary with Daniel, in a passage in which he warns Judah of her impending judgment, writes this of Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans. So he's speaking here of Nebuchadnezzar. A lion has gone up from his thicket. A destroyer of nations has set out. He has gone out from his place to make your land a waste. Your cities will be in ruins without inhabitants. Then there's another passage in which Jeremiah is warning Edom of the same judgment. In this passage, he refers to Nebuchadnezzar as an eagle, one of the other symbols that we have here in Daniel. He writes in chapter 49, he will mount up and swoop like an eagle. He'll spread his wings against Bozrah, that's a city in Edom. And the hearts of the mighty men of Edom in that day will be like the heart of a woman in labor. We also know from archaeological discoveries that statues of winged lions symbolized the Chaldean Empire. Now, the Chaldeans borrowed this from the Assyrians, but during the day of Daniel, there are many people who would have understood this imagery to have been a clear reference to Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldean Empire. And remember, this prophecy came while Belshazzar was still the king. Daniel says, I continued looking. This is the second of the tenfold use of that participle that I mentioned earlier when we talked about verse 2. Daniel continued observing with intense interest to see what was going to happen next. What Daniel saw here were wings on this beast that were rendered useless because I suppose the feathers were pulled out. I wasn't able to determine whether the wings were actually pulled off the beast or whether the feathers were pulled out of the wings, but the point is they are no longer effective. This very well may be an historical reference to Nebuchadnezzar's bout with insanity. That may well be true, but it also symbolizes the general weakening of the empire through incompetent leadership. Certainly the idea of a lion or an eagle are metaphors that refer very clearly to Nebuchadnezzar, but his successors were weak and the empire fell. Daniel says this beast was lifted up and made to stand on 2 feet. A lion, of course, walks on 4 legs. An eagle has 2 feet, but we think of it more in terms of its 2 wings. It flies. It's a man who walks on 2 feet. So the empire is viewed here as becoming more manlike. It's exchanging the strength of the lion and the swiftness of the eagle for the 2 feet of a man. And then it says a man's heart was given to it. We know that Nebuchadnezzar ruled more humanely after his restoration, and this may be the primary meaning of the phrase, but it also may point to this overall weakening of the empire, indicating that the ferocity of the lion, Nebuchadnezzar, was replaced by self-serving rulers like Belshazzar, who had just come to power when Daniel had his first vision. Verse 5 describes the second beast, which is said to be like a bear. We're told it was raised up on one side. It has 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told to arise and eat meat. keeping with Daniel's statement in verse 3 that each of these beasts was different from the others, this second beast resembles not a lion, but it resembles a bear. The word another means a beast distinct from the first, but different in kind from all the others. And the word second denotes its place in the sequence of the Gentile empires. It's the same thing we discussed back when we talked about the first dream of Nebuchadnezzar, that the head of gold was the Chaldean Empire, and then when you move to the breast and arms of silver, we were moving in succession to the empire that would come after the Chaldeans, of course, the Medo-Persian Empire, and that's what's in view here. In his denunciation of Babylon and the Chaldeans in Isaiah chapter 13, the prophet previews the overthrow of the Chaldeans by the Medes and the Persians. So this was also prophesied in Isaiah. Isaiah wrote, "Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against him. They will not value silver nor take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They'll not have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye have pity for children." It's not really clear what the phrase "that was raised up on one side" means, but if I were forced to guess, I would think that it indicates that this Medo-Persian Empire, which was becoming one empire, but it still existed in two parts for a while, but it indicates here one side was raised up, that one of the two empires symbolized here will be stronger than the other. And of course, this is borne out in history. The Persian Empire eventually usurped all of the power from the Medes, and only for about a 40-year period was this ever referred to as the Medo-Persian Empire. This interpretation that this refers to the Persians is supported by Daniel's second vision. If we were to look ahead at chapter 8, we would see that as we progress through these chapters, that the first vision of chapter 7 provides an overview of future things. The overview then is expanded in the next three visions, each of which illuminates a portion of the first vision. And as an example of that, Daniel 8:3 parallels this verse in Daniel 7, verse 5. In chapter 8, there's a ram. It's not a bear this time, it's a ram. And it has two horns, and one horn is longer than the other. This is the same imagery, just spoken differently as the bear with one side raised up. And that's the way he describes the increased power of the Persians over the Medes in chapter 7. The ram with two horns, one longer than the other. Of course, the longer horn represents, again, the Persian. This is an expansion in chapter 8 on what we see in chapter 7. In this bear's mouth, there are three ribs. Gleason Archer, who's a great expositor and theologian, correctly identifies these three ribs as the three major conquests of the Medo-Persian Empire. They first conquered Babylon in 539 BC. They went on to conquer Lydia, which is modern-day western Turkey, in 546 BC. And then in Egypt, they conquered Egypt in 525 BC. There's an interesting phrase, "and this they said to it," that is to the beast. We're not told who they are. It just says they said. I think this simply refers to the providential role of the Medo-Persian Empire in God's plan during the time of the Gentiles. What the beast is told is to arise, devour much meat. It depicts a very ferocious nature of this ancient kingdom. The lust for land drove the Persians to expand their empire beyond any kingdom that had existed before it. The borders of Persia eventually stretched from Egypt and the Aegean on the west all the way to the Indus River on the east, something that had never been conquered to that extent before. Verse 6 then describes the third beast. It's said to be like a leopard. This beast has four wings like a bird. It had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, again, indicates that Daniel is still following this sequence, which is laid out in chapter 2. This is the Greek Empire, corresponding to the belly and thighs of bronze in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. We have the third occurrence of the participle. He says, "I continued looking." This is still emphasizing Daniel's intense interest in the vision and that this vision held his full attention. The beast resembles a leopard. It arises again from the sea, out of the Gentile nations. And I want you to notice the language that we've seen so far. In verse 4, Daniel doesn't say a lion arose from the sea. He says a beast that was like a lion. In verse 5, he doesn't say that it was a bear. He said it was a beast that resembles a bear. And then in verse 6, he doesn't say that this is an actual leopard. He sees something like a leopard appearing in his vision. And this use of language, he's using similes. He's using a figure of speech that tells us we're to understand something here beyond the animal. We're to understand that these represent the empires that we've been discussing. And this is the third empire, the Greek Empire, under Alexander the Great. Now, a leopard is an appropriate symbol for Alexander and the Greeks. The three beasts that are mentioned, the lion, the bear, and the leopard is the swiftest of the three, and it's a trait that I think is further emphasized by the fact that it has these four wings like a bird. I mentioned last week, I think it was last week, that Linda and I used to work with big cats at a rescue facility that is out north of Fort Worth. We learned a lot about those cats, which is a good thing if you're going to have a lion sitting in your lap. You need to know something about what you're doing. We learned a lot about them, and I can tell you without hesitation, the leopard is the most dangerous of the big cats. It's not the biggest. Male leopard will weigh 160 to 180 pounds. The biggest big cat is a Siberian tiger that can weigh 800 pounds. Leopard's not the strongest. That also would be the tiger, followed by a lion being a close second behind the tiger. A leopard is not the fastest animal. That would be the cheetah. But a leopard is stealthy. And it's most likely of all the cats to engage in an unprovoked attack that the victim would never see coming. They spend a lot of time in trees. I've got time to tell you this. We had a favorite cat out there. I think I can speak for Linda. His name was Onyx. The first day I saw him, he was a black leopard. First day I saw Onyx, he was 4 months old, and I walked up and I picked him up and I threw him over my neck, and I had his front paws in my left hand and his hind legs in my right hand, and we just walked around and got to know one another. When he grew up, he was a big leopard, big male. He was 180 pounds, and he was black. And in his enclosure, which was larger than this room, there was a tree, and he used to spend time up in the tree, and when I would go in his cage, he would walk headfirst down the tree. I don't know how he did it, but just walk down the tree. He'd get within about 15 feet of the ground and just jump. We had this big platform that we sat on, and Onyx would come and jump up and put his head in my lap and suck my thumb. Now, he had been doing that since he was 4 months old, and I had no fear of this animal, but every time you went out there, or we went out there, we had to make a decision as to whether something had changed, because leopards do have the ability to make this sudden change in their personalities. But I can just tell you that we had many leopards there. A leopard is not an animal unless you have a special relationship with it that you want to fool with. It's fast, but it's stealthy. And most of the time when a leopard attacks, its victim has absolutely no idea that the attack was coming. Alexander the Great, in terms of his military success and the way he fought, is correctly and appropriately represented by a leopard. This beast is similar in form and nature to a leopard, but it differs in that it has four heads. I think two things are in view here. The heads represent intelligence, and if nothing else, Alexander was a master strategist. But more significantly, the heads speak to what happened to Alexander's kingdom after his death. His kingdom was divided into four sections assigned to each of his four generals. Lysimachus ruled Thrace and Bithynia. Cassander ruled Macedonia and Greece. Seleucus controlled Babylonia and the territories that extended east to India. And Ptolemy ruled Egypt, Palestine, and Arabia. So the four heads represent what occurred after the death of Alexander to the Greek, Macedonian Greek empire. We have the fourth beast in verses 7 and 8. It's a beast that seems to have no earthly counterpart. When he describes this beast, he doesn't say it's like a leopard or it's like a bear or it's like a lion. He doesn't use that type of metaphor. J.A. Montgomery, who's written a lot on the book of Daniel, says this fourth beast defies any zoological category. So I guess that's a fancy way of saying it wasn't a leopard, a bear, or a lion. The description here in Daniel of this beast is that it was dreadful and terrifying, that it was extremely strong, that it had large teeth made of iron, that it devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts, and it had a very unique characteristic. It had 10 horns. In the opening scripture, one of the reasons I chose that Revelation 13 passage today is that it's commonly thought that that chapter of Revelation parallels this vision in Daniel. And recall verse 2 of that opening scripture reading, Revelation 13, 2. John says, "The beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like a bear's, and his mouth was the mouth of a lion." So, though the fourth beast is not described in this way in Daniel, we may presume that it shared characteristics with the previous three. That's why I've written up here that the fourth beast was probably a composite, although it's not described. What makes this beast different from the other three? Well, one thing is that it is extremely strong, its strength. The attributes of this beast, teeth of iron, a dreadful and terrifying nature, and the ability to trample adversaries, all of these things amplify our appreciation for the strength of the fourth creature. This is the Roman Empire, the legs of iron and the feet of clay from Daniel chapter 2. In chapter 2, verse 40, the empire there is described as strong as iron, and it's an empire that breaks into pieces all things. These characteristics represented in chapter 7 by the teeth of iron. Like the beast of chapter 2, this beast has feet. Verse 19, which we'll study next week, supplements verse 7 by mentioning claws of bronze by which the destructive power of the feet are implied. We have then the phrase, "I continued looking." This is the fourth occurrence of that participle. Daniel is very intently involved with what he's seeing. And then we have this phrase that it trampled down the remainder with its feet. And I think what we're to understand here is that what was not devoured initially was destroyed then in this manner. There was nothing left when the Romans would come through and decimate an area. The point to emphasize is the great strength and the power of the fourth empire. Rome shared a lot of the attributes of its predecessors, but it exceeded them in ways that made it unlike the empires that came before it. You could argue that the differences were differences of degree rather than differences in kind, but you'd have to say that Rome exceeded anything that came before it. But there's another significant difference that we need to notice here, and that is that this particular beast has 10 horns. Horns in Scripture typify kings. Horns typify kings. And in fact, verse 24 of this chapter, if we were to look ahead to that, in the interpretive section, he says, "As for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise." So we know that the 10 horns are representative of kings. Leon Wood, who's a great commentator on Daniel, argues that there will come a time when Rome will be restored, and the 10 kings represented in Daniel's vision by the 10 horns will rule as contemporaries. We covered this in some detail in lesson number 5 when we were in chapter 2. I pointed out that the fourth empire must be understood in two ways, in a dual sense. First, as the Roman Empire that ruled over Europe, parts of Africa and the Middle East, including Palestine, both before, during, and after the time of Christ. But it must also be understood as a restored empire that will reach its ultimate power during the Great Tribulation under Antichrist. We discussed back in chapter 2 the possibility that a kernel of this confederation of states is already present in the world in the form of the European Union. In fact, I cited a quote from Winston Churchill in which he said, "The only hope for Europe is a United States of Europe." This was his comment after World War II. And if you'll allow me to do so, I'll repeat just for the record what Churchill said in his exact words. He said, "There is a remedy which would in a few years make all of Europe free and happy. It is to recreate the European family, or as much of it as we can, and to provide it with a structure under which it can dwell in peace and in safety and in freedom. Then he says, we must build a kind of United States of Europe. Churchill didn't realize he was verbalizing something that one day would set the stage for the fulfillment of this prophecy of Daniel. Nor did he know that the political structure that he envisioned one day would be the governmental structure through which the Antichrist will rule during the Great Tribulation. And I said back when we studied this, and I'll say it again here, we cannot say with any degree of certainty that today's EU or European Union will be the same European Confederation of the Tribulation, but the similarity in structure is such that the possibility that it is the same cannot be ignored. All that we've discussed in the context of Daniel chapter 2 is true of Daniel chapter 7 because they tell the same story. One uses the imagery of a great statue, the other uses the imagery of great beasts. Daniel 2 points to the day when the rule of 10 kings will be ended by the God who establishes kingdoms and who tears down kings and kingdoms. He'll do it on the day when he establishes his own eternal kingdom. Daniel 7 tells the same story by the image of a great beast with 10 horns. Now, we have more detail in chapter 7, but the event to which chapters 2 and 7 point are the same event. It's further described in Revelation chapter 17, where the 10 horns also depict 10 kings. Then in verse 8, Daniel tells us that another horn, which he calls a little horn, will uproot 3 horns, and this little horn has eyes like the eyes of a man. He says, I was contemplating the horn. This is another occurrence of a participle. It uses a different verb, but it's the same construction. The difference being here he's substituting his intent interest with thinking and understanding. He's really thinking about what he's seeing. He speaks of this other little horn. Another distinguishes it from the other ten. Little indicates that this horn was small in the beginning. But if we were to look forward to verse 20, we will see that it doesn't remain small. It grows in power so that its power exceeds the power and the influence of the other horns. So there is, in effect, a power grab here. 3 of the 10 horns are uprooted. This leaves 8 rulers, 10 minus 3 plus the little horn, or 7 if, in fact, the little horn is one of the original 10. I don't think it's clear which case it is. Exactly which rulers are uprooted, we're not told, but what's clear is that at the end of the little horn's escalation to prominence, the little horn has full control of the reconstituted Roman Empire, and the other kings are subservient to him. So let me try to sum this up. In the latter days, I think soon after the rapture, 10 rulers will be leading. I think they'll already be in place. They'll be leading a confederation of European states, which the text implies as the reconstituted Roman Empire. From among these leaders, there will emerge the little horn. That he begins small and then grows in power and influence may imply subtlety. It may not be apparent at first that his motive is world domination. In fact, he'll have all kinds of positive humanitarian reasons for what he does. At first, his power will begin to increase behind the scenes. But when the opportunity is right, he'll emerge as a violent opponent. Then the 10 kings or leaders will not see what's about to take place, just like a leopard's victim rarely sees the attack in time to anticipate it. The idea of a subtle rise to power followed by a violent overthrow is exactly what the term that's used in the Aramaic text means. The word is akar. It's translated to uproot, but what it really means is a progressive display of force. It's a force that begins rather small and subtly in the background and increases to a great level of intensity. The last two characteristics mentioned are the little horn has eyes like the eyes of a man, and he has a mouth speaking great things. The eyes of the man indicate a couple of things. This little horn will have a human personality. I don't believe he's a supernatural creature by any stretch. He'll be a man, but he'll be a man who receives his power directly from Satan himself. The eyes also imply the ability to learn and to communicate effectively. One of the ways we communicate with each other is through the eyes. If you can't see someone's eyes, sometimes you won't have the full nuance of what's being said. It's part of our ability to communicate. And this little horn will be shrewd. He'll have a lot of charisma, and he will have the ability to persuade. We're also told that he has a mouth speaking great things. This refers to claims he will make about himself, but perhaps more significantly, the blasphemy that he will utter against God that'll be a major part of his message. As revolting as this may sound to us as believers, the blasphemy and self-promotion will persuade the majority of the population of the world that this one is worthy of their worship. He will be the best politician the world has ever seen. John's description of the Antichrist in Revelation 13, verses 5 through 8, and in 17, 11 through 14, matches Daniel's description of this little horn. The little horn of Daniel 7 is the Antichrist. He is Satan's counterfeit world dictator. It's really hard to know where to break this chapter. There's way too much material in it for one lesson, so as improper homiletically as it may be to do so, I'm simply going to stop and let you know that we'll pick up with verse 9 next Sunday. So that's not a very eloquent ending, but that was it. I'll stick around if you have any questions. John, would you close us in prayer?